It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a legend, the youth is here, Sammy Siegler from the bands Youth of Today, Gorilla Biscuits, Limp Bizkit. Side by side. There's a lot. This guy, we can just go through his discography forever. He's played in a lot of incredible bands. Someone I've wanted to talk to for years. I tell him that he was like the guy we looked up to as the kid. Like, we could see ourselves as him as young people. And someone I've gotten to hang out with various times over the years. A very cool person. And I'm very excited for you to hear this very fun episode. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who is the show producer and the guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. This is why Tristan is so amazing, because I've known Sammy for a very long time. I've been talking to Sammy for a very long time about coming on this podcast, but Tristan is the one who gets it done. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. If you are looking for me, I am on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. There's a TikTok page, a Facebook page, a YouTube page, a Instagram page, all those for Turned Out of Punk. Those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that is done each and every week here. I am also in a band called Fucked Up. We have a brand new record called Another Day. I'm very proud of it. Check it out over there on those streaming services. And if you want to get a very special edition, you can get the Turned Out of Punk edition over at Emissions Records. You can find Emissions Records here in Toronto. Just Google that shit. It'll come up. It's on Instagram. And Emissions Records comes up today in this very episode. I'm going to say it. Jerry O'Connell's favorite Canadian punk store. Yes, that's right. Jerry O'Connell from Stand By Me. Listen, keep listening, and this will all be explained as we get there. Yeah, that's it. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, Sammy Siegler is on the show today from the band Youth of Today, from the band Gorilla Biscuits he played in, from the band Side by Side he played in, from the band, oh my gosh, we can just go forever with Sammy's various projects. He is, as I said, a very cool person. Someone, I think probably the first person I met from this scene when I saw Rival Schools play in Brighton, and I went up to him and just started talking to him, and he was just, yeah, just chill as fuck. And it's still all these years later, a chill dude. This is a great episode, so I don't really want to set this up too much. These days, Sammy can be found playing in Youth of the Day, playing in Rival Schools, playing in various bands that he is doing, also doing stuff for the incredible Trust Records, a label that if you are not familiar with, you kind of need to check out what they've been doing for the last few years, because they've been reissuing a lot of the canon of American hardcore. I guess there's no other way to put it. Some of the greatest records of all time, in my opinion. And Sammy has been helping them out, as well as doing stuff with his foundational record label that he came up with, and a record label that is, well, without hyperbole, a real cornerstone of this thing called Hardcore, Revelation Records. So you can check out the stuff they're doing over there. Sammy's been doing some great playlist stuff with Revelation and all sorts of stuff. So check out that. I'm not going to ramble on. I've got some links over there in the description for where you can find Sammy and various things that Sammy's up to. This is a good one. I'm excited for you to hear it. And that's it. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sammy Siegler, the youth, unturned out a punk. Sammy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is cool.
Well, as I had to force myself from not saying to you off air a minute ago, I feel like this has been a long time coming because getting into this kind of music, you were always like, I think, the avatar for a lot of younger kids getting into this stuff, because you look at the pictures, you're younger than me at by the time of getting into this stuff when you're first playing at it. So it was always like, oh, that's the kid at the center of this storm. So there's a lot for me to get to with you today.
Yeah, I was, you know, there's something about those photos. Like when you're little, you're little. There's no way around it. You know, when I look back at those photos, it's like, shit, I was like 11, 12, 13. It's pretty bugged out. Even Freddie or Luke or other young dudes, it's always just cool to see that.
Well, it's interesting. I've always thought there's like a place to do almost like a documentary about young kids in hardcore bands, be it like, you know, Stephen McDonald from Red Cross or Tommy Stinson from The Replacements or the kid who sang in Mad Society or the guy from Eater, you know, like all kids that were like 18 or under in these bands. And then I'm sure, as we'll talk about, like in very adult worlds a lot of times.
Yeah, I guess everyone had different experiences. We recently helped with Trust Records and we did an interview with Harley, and he talked about a lot of things, but he was sort of saying how, you know, we were talking about Max's Kansas City and what was it like, and he was just like, man, that was no place for a kid. And his experience was kind of maybe a little darker, but again, that was a different time. Mine was like really just rooted in friendship. It was like, these are my like best friends. Let's go do shit. Whether that's making a record or going to a show or, you know, going to Dojo's or, you know, some health food restaurant or something. It was fun.
Well, I think it speaks to the positivity of, I guess, straight edge, but in particular youth crew to kind of fall into as a young punk kid and having friends that fell into some of these other streams of punk that you kind of would fall into where self-destruction was not as looked down upon. And mm-hmm. a lot of these friends that didn't make it out of these situations as, because they're getting into it as young kids and the heroes they were kind of looking up to weren't telling them to, like, you know, eat their vegetables and be straight edge. And I'm like, you know, obviously I'm not straight edge anymore. And I know there's some people that are like, oh, it's so dogmatic, there's all these problems with it. But like, what a cool, as a parent, I say this, trend for your kid to fall into where they're just
so
like,
cool.
Yeah, it's cool not to drink. It's cool not to do drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely I'm a father too. And it's like, yeah, you can't really control, like, you know, force your kid into like, now get into straight edge. But I just fell into it. One thing which is interesting to point out, which I was talking to Ray Capo about recently, but I guess it's just like how kind of accepting older kids were letting young kids hang out. Because in other settings, like in high school, you know, if you're 16, you're not hanging out with a 15-year-old or if you're a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old. Like I was, you know, like 14 in Youth of Today, and Ray was like maybe 20 or 21. And we would like fight like brothers, but for the most part, like, you know, him, Purcell, Walter, they'd let me hang out. Alex Brown, all my guys. Like, so I think, or even in the scene, like to have different ages, like at CB's on a Sunday or whatever, like all kind of working together was, because yeah, in high school that wasn't allowed, right?
Yeah, no, and definitely. And like, even as a parent now, I don't know how I'd feel. Like I had friends that were in their like 50s that I traded records with when I was, you know, 16 years old.
Right.
And as a parent of a 15-year-old that they brought home like a 50-year-old person to trade records with, I'd be like, I don't know what this vibe is. But you're right. It's like, it is almost this like Peter Pan Neverland thing where you're always a hardcore kid, no matter how old you are.
Yeah. I mean, I tribute a lot. I grew up in New York City, downtown Manhattan. And so I have an older sister. So you kind of just grow up fast, which I did. And I kind of, you know, first got into punk and destroy and was smoking pot and cigarettes. And I did acid by accident. And like, I kind of went that route first. And then I met the straight edge dudes and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I love it. You know, I mean, it was, yeah, the Sex Pistols and all that shit was fun, but the straight edge shit was just so much cooler. And my parents were cool too. And so my house was like the hangout. So everyone would come to my house. My mom would make food for us all. And like, so it happened, although it happened fast, like 14 to 15 to 16, it also was kind of gradual for where it was like, okay, my parents are taking me to the show at the old Ritz or Seabees. Okay, my sister is. Okay, now I'm going with a friend. Now I'm going by myself. Or like, we're going to go play a show this weekend in DC, and then boom, we're going to the West Coast for a week, and now we're going around the US in the summer of 88. So like, it kind of just, there was like baby steps, but they happened quickly.
Well, I guess that brings me to the question, which is, Sammy, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yeah, the punk stuff. I want to say like my sister, and like there was like the kind of, I guess like the what I like Devo kind of punk, where I was like, this is cool, like new wave, like Blondie, that sort of thing. And then, I mean, there was like, I lived on 15th Street, so 8th Street had a cool record store, and they had a store called 8th Street between 5th and 6th was like the shit back then, which you wouldn't think because it was all about St. Mark's Place for everyone else. But like 8th Street between 5th and 6th had Electric Ladyland, but they had a store called Butterfly, which like had all the punk shirts, like Nazi punks fuck off with like a line going through the swastika and like exploited t-shirts and shit. So I would just like walk down there. It was amazing. Like, let me get that t-shirt. I don't know what it is, but I just want it. And then I very quickly, I met my friend Matt Pincus, who was a year older than me. I was like 11, he was 12. I met him at orientation. I was like, hey man, are you punk rock? He's like, yeah, I'm punk rock. Are you punk rock? And so from there, we watched like Suburbia, we watched Repo Man, and we watched Decline, and we just like doubled down on it and got into it. And it was like, yeah, I mean, just getting Thrasher and reading those like two or three pages where they talked about music, but just kind of being punk and not like, again, we were like very young, so we would, panhandle like just because we thought it was punk, hang out at St. Mark's Place, and just kind of be punk because it's so attractive too. Like, I guess when you think about, I mean, you're so to be a parent, right? So you think about what your kids gravitate towards. It's interesting how like suicidal tendencies still attracts people, because the branding is so fucking strong, right? Like the music, I saw your mommy and your mommy was dead, these like skeletons, all this cool shit. So punk had this insane branding that I think was just so like, I mean, I was into Kiss, right? Younger, like sixth grade, like whatever that is, 10 years old or something. So I guess I was attracted to some of that, just like over the top theatrics, like fucking fire and makeup. And then it's like punk and holy shit, I'm in.
And music lives up to it in a way, like with punk, that it doesn't with Kiss and the Grateful Dead. Like these bands that have this like spooky, heavy imagery, and then you hear the music, you're like, that's it.
You're right. Yeah, the music was badass. I mean, the Never Mind the Bollocks is a great record. The Clash make great records. They're like some, not all hardcore. I feel like you can pick up 30 years later and listen to and be like, whoa, I'm in. But whereas like the Ramones, you can do it. Like it shit is so good,
Well, how much awareness did you have of that sort of New York hardcore stuff? Because there was that moment where it was, there's that, I guess the infamous Donahue, there's that New York Magazine article, and then there's like a Regis and Kathie Lee that had rabies on it with Todd Youth. So there's like that moment where there's like media kind of like fear being drummed up around it. Like, how aware of that stuff? Like, were you seeing these kids around at that point too?
I feel like I just missed that. I mean, I did my homework as soon as I got into hardcore and would like see and heard about it and then I'd watch it. But I feel like I just missed that. But for me, my sister got me into, I guess, my first band. It was called Noise Police. And it was with these two older kids, Alex and Toby, that went to Stuyvesant High School. And so the band was called Noise Police. And we had a song called like Fun with Ron, which was about Ronald Reagan. It was like political punk. Then we had some reggae songs. And then they covered Power by Agnostic Front. So
Oh,
that
that's
was sort of
awesome.
my introduction. So I was probably 11. They would smoke weed. I'd smoke weed. I could barely play drums. You know what I mean? Stone. Like, we rehearsed at my dad had like a little studio in his apartment that we'd rehearse at, and we would play really fucking random shows. Like, it's one of these things that when I think about it, it's like I don't even believe it happened. But there was a thing called the Village Independent Democrats in Greenwich Village that we played that, and the cops came and broke it up. And my friend Matt Pincus got he didn't get arrested, but they put him in the car. But then they did their thing called Founders Day for Stuyvesant High School, where they played on the Circle Line ferry, and it went to some island, like maybe Governor's Island or something. But the whole fucking high school was on this boat, and we played on it. And I heard that some kid jumped off. I know a kid jumped through this plate glass window on the boat. Like it was fucking, I mean, my memory of it again as an 11, 12-year-old was really nuts. But I think that was my introduction to hardcore, like learning how to play power, that beat. And then being like, oh shit, Agnostic Front, what's that? And then very quickly, my friend met Walter Schreifel's brother Dylan, and Dylan was like, my brother's got this band called Gorilla Biscuits. They need a drummer. And so then I was in Gorilla Biscuits and I played my first kind of real hardcore show, which was the Birth of Unity show out at the Right Track Inn in Long Island. And I think that's kind of where it was just like, it's on. Now I know about fucking, I think like, I don't have that flyer, but I feel like Warzone played, maybe Token Entry, like a lot of, it was a real Birth of Unity moment for me.
It's like a legendary show. Was that your first like time going to like, I guess you've been to live music before this, but like to like a punk show?
Yes. Yeah. Like to like, I'm going to, what is it? Freeport, Long Island. That alone was weird. My dad drove me and two of my friends out. He was going to fly. I guess he got recently divorced and was like midlife crisis. He had this like Mitsubishi kind of fancy car. And we stopped at White Castle and we got burgers. And Walter's brother, Dylan, felt sick, threw up outside the window on the way to the show, all over the side of my dad's car. My dad dropped us off. These metalhead kids were fucking with us. Jason Crackdown came to the rescue and was just like, yo, like, leave the little kids alone kind of thing. It was just such like a, you know, like getting jumped in kind of moment. I remember Eric Fink from Side by Side was there and he did a stage dive from the back, which you never do. So he like landed on people's backs and some dude got pissed off at him and I think tried to fight him. And then I stayed at Walter and Dylan's house, which was also just bugged out because I never really, growing up in the city, like I never really went to Queens. They lived in, I think, Astoria. So that, yeah, that felt like, yes, prior to that, I had gone to, you know, the old Ritz a lot. I have some cool ticket stubs from like Dead Kennedys and GBH and things, but never went to like, you know, CB's or the Pyramid or, you know, I was too young for whatever A7 and some of the earlier shit. But, that kind of kicked it off. And I think shortly after that, I feel like I went to CB's.
I guess like, that time period is very storied, but it's also, kind of like a violent time period in New York too. Like a lot of
Yeah.
people who've come on the show that grew up in particular New York City around that time talk about how they were mugged multiple times. Like just it's like it's a hairy place to be just like a kid, period, let alone punk or hardcore.
I have really fond memories. I feel like I do have a few friends that I don't know if it's just like, yeah, like they were always getting jumped and a gun got pulled on them and a knife got pulled on them. There's always something. I kind of like, I don't know if it's street smarts or luck, but I was able to just sort of navigate it in a way. I mean, I grew up on 15th between 5th and 6th at the time was pretty funky. Like Union Square Park was not nice, but you know, I would go to school and hang out with my friends, I guess, and there was, you know, I had like a just a good nose for street smarts or something. I feel like I would sniff it out. And I mean, I was always, there was definitely times where I was around it and it was close, but I avoided some major shit. And then the hardcore scene, I guess because I was younger, like didn't these older dudes that were like, you know, just seem so fucking crazy. Like they just seem more like superheroes to me in a way. You know, like I wasn't old enough to be in the shit with them where I was like, oh my God, they might jump me or something, I guess, you know? But as I got older, like in high school, like there was, yeah, there was it got a little hairy. And then the hardcore scene like later got, I think, more violent. And that's where I maybe because I was older, I felt more threatened.
Yeah, like that's definitely something that's come up on the show as New York goes on in hardcore, right from the very beginning too. Like it's going back to like Stimulators kind of era. It seems like it gets harder and harder each era to the point where by the end of the 80s into the 90s, it's like the hardcore scene, like capital H hard.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, I always look back to like 87, you know, the Together 7-inch on Rev, then the Way It Is comp, and then Some Records was a store on 6th Street. And I remember like just like how unified it was from, you know, Warzone to Youth of Today to Underdog to Token Entry to Altercation to YDL to whatever it was. Like, I remember like Ray Bees wrote like some sign like, yo, we're having this softball game at Tompkins Square Park. Like, come down. You know what I mean? It was like that kind of vibe. There were shows Saturday at the Pyramid. There were shows Sundays at Seabees. There was, you know, Friday at the Anthrax occasion in Connecticut. It just felt really, yeah. Like again, like I was saying earlier, we'd go to like Dojo's, was like this health food restaurant, and Quantum Leap, and some other health food spots. And like my crew, my like youth crew thing, for those years, 87, 88, specifically 89, like felt really just like, I guess, protected or something. Although when we went on tour, that's when it was like, whoa, we're in the South and shit's a little wild and there's Nazi skinheads. And so for me, that was 88 in the US, 89 in Europe. That was, you know, yes, there was moments on those tours where it was like, wow, someone's got a gun.
Well, and I think it's interesting when you guys go on tour because it's almost like, I think it's like Lenny K in the History of Punk documentary talks about that first Patti Smith tour and how they play these shows and the people that would wind up being in X are in the audience, or the people that wind up being in this band are in the audience. It seems like Youth of the Day had kind of the similar effect where everywhere you guys went in your wake, there was like a youth crew scene that kind of sprung up, or bands started dressing more like you guys, and it really had like kind of a polarizing effect on a lot of scenes, it seems like, too.
Like I said, that 87 time was really exciting because you had Nausea, you had Punks, Skins, Straight Edge all together. Everyone looks different at the show. It's really cool. Very shortly after, our youth crew Straight Edge scene grew, and you know, a lot of the kids looked the same and kind of only really want to listen to the Straight Edge bands. And that was kind of the scene, like specifically at the Anthrax. You know, 89 going to Europe with Youth Today, it was still really punk and really, it was like almost like 10 years ago. When I went back in 91 with Gorilla Biscuits, Straight Edge had like taken off. And so, I mean, I think the upside of that is like, shit, what we were doing really was special and it grew and people just wanted to be with it and start their own bands and have that look and have that vibe. The downside is, yeah, you lost some of that diversity. You lost some of that, you know, which, you know, like I was a punk first. So I like deep down, I like, you know, I love straight edge and hardcore, but I also like punk. It's gotta have an edge to it. It's gotta be different. The punk ethos are special.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of made of the way you guys dressed. But I think it's just because that's the way you guys dress. Like more I've done this podcast, I realize that the reason Rollins wore those short shorts is because Bill also wore them and they were functional for them. That it wasn't like any sort of direct attack on the audience. Like I'm sure maybe that was there some way, but like I think as you guys went like around the world, and especially as we've moved away from that time period temporally, this stuff has become harder to acquire and more expensive, and it's kind of taken on this mystique where people have to look a certain way. But it's just like, I don't know, from the way it looks in the photos, just the way you guys were dressing, just because that's what you bought.
Yeah, I guess you could tie it to like quality in a way. Like we, you know, Straight Edge was about like bettering your life and bettering the world around you. And therefore we liked, you know, maybe like just good shit. Like let's go for like instead of eating slop, let's eat good shit. Let's eat healthy food. Let's take care of our bodies. Let's make quality zines and make quality, you know, t-shirts on good 100% cotton or, you know, whatever it is, like trying to maybe go further into that. And yeah, there was a functional element like cargo pants, but there's little things that, you know, like I guess I credit like Purcell a lot for where, yeah, I was talking to somebody this the other day, but just like, you know, he would like cuff his pants like really tight and roll them up or like cut the bottoms of the t-shirts off or the sleeves off and they would roll up. I don't know, you know, you'd have to ask him where he got that from, but that kind of shit took on. And then also what was interesting too was like Capo and Richie Birkenhead and a few people like worked at nightclubs to make money. So they worked at like the Tunnel. And at that time, it was this melting pot and hip hop was coming up and house music was there. And New York was this like really interesting, you know, melting pot of culture. So I think that they were picking up on that. And like with Capo, we'd always have this joke about like being the king of East Village, you know, the king of fashion or you know, having your finger on the pulse kind of thing. And he would push the envelope. I mean, whether it worked or not, or whether it took on, I don't know. But having biker shorts, right? Or like that haircut on the cover, Break Down the Walls, or like the low top Doc Martin shoes on the back of the Disengage 7-inch, you know, he would just kind of throw some curveballs. But yeah, the fashion, I guess, you know, every scene's got their thing, right? So punks had leather jackets and whatnot, and skins had flight jackets, and we had our champions, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting how
it almost becomes like a religion to
Yeah.
kids, where like you dress this way, like, oh, champions. Okay, we're gonna get champion shirts. I remember going to the Champion Outlet being like, oh my God, finally, I'm set for life with sweatshirts, or
Yeah.
you know, buying these shoes and trying to get your hair cut a certain way, trying to get a fade. I remember
Yeah.
my friends trying to go to barbershops. I was always knew where my hair was going, so I accepted my fate. But my friends were going around to barbershops getting fades, you know, different like barbershops in different parts of Toronto, like just looking to where do you kind of emulate this style, or how do you emulate this style?
Yeah. I just saw a photo this morning actually that popped up of Agnostic Front, like maybe 83. Ray Bees was in the band, but like Vinny's got an X shaved in his head, like on top of his head. And they all had X's on their hands, but it said AF. But it was really cool because, you know, later we shaved X's in the back of our head. And but yeah, I don't know. So sorry, was that a question or
No, I was just saying it's amazing how it did become like this sort of thing that everyone starts, not everyone obviously, but like there's kids around the world start emulating and looking at, not just in because that's how they want to dress, but almost like, how do I follow in these footsteps?
I mean, a lot of it was touring, showing up, right? Just like just old school door to door, showing up, playing a show for five kids, playing a show for 500 kids, and putting the time in. Like we would hang out, we would stay at kids' houses pretty much every night. You know, we would talk to usually like the scene, like the one kid that got it, the one kid that was a Youth Today fans, for example. You know, we would hang with that kid and we'd make a bond that a lot of those kids were still friends with today. But I think that those seeds that were planted in that hang, like that shit grew, you know, and so you saw it in Europe, you know, for sure, where like Belgium kind of got it early. I don't know why, but like Belgium knew about Straight Edge. And then again, I went back in that like 2 years later and it had grown. And it's also just a cool, I don't know, I guess it was a cool style. Like for us, we, you know, Ray Capo talks a lot about like punk was like destroy, 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 like fuck the world. And he didn't want to go that route. And I think that's what, you know, that speaks to me a lot too, of just like I was punk. It was cool. I was a skin. That was fun. I did it. I dressed like that. I was fully into the whole shit. But Straight Edge was like, I'm with this. You know, I like this t-shirt over the champion. I like this crew cut, you know, with my X shaved in the back of my head. I like, you know, it just worked for me. The sneakers, fucking Air Revolutions, are more comfortable than 14-holed steel-toed Docs.
I remember there's this article that came out in AP magazine around like 96, 97. They were doing like these retrospective looks back at different punk scenes. And they did one about Youth Crew. I don't know if you remember that thing that came out, or about Youth of Today, kind of like that moment, the summer of Youth Crew, I think they called it.
I think I see it had the photo of more of like those smorgasbord kind of kids, that scene of them all walking down the street. Was it that
I
article?
think so. It must maybe, but it was definitely about summer of 88 and just sort of this moment where it felt like Youth Crew was going to happen. Like there was like going to be this thing. And then you look at the face writing the article about Youth of Today back then. And like sort of it did feel like there's this moment where it did have this sort of larger youth, popping off moment. Could you feel that around then being
I
in it?
remember like when, yes, because so Youth Today, like I joined in 87 and then we got signed to Caroline Records, which was just like this, you know, emerging indie label that was, you know, way more big time than what we were used to. And so there was that. And then I remember like Michael Alago was at MCA Records and he was like, I want to have a meeting with you guys. We went to his office and he was playing Run on the Saloon and, you know, it's such a fucking crazy sounding record, but he was just like, I love it. So if all this different, you know, and we got like a little bit of money from Caroline, so we was able to buy a drum set and we had equipment. And so it all like it was ramped up. It felt different, you know. Yes, you felt it growing. And then again, like being able to go to Europe or for me to go to the West Coast or, you know, do, you know, I think when I look back or even now, hopefully too, it all kind of keeps growing and moving forward and new, because I need like new experiences. Like I don't, you know, I love playing drums and hardcore and I've been doing it my whole life, but one thing that's been nice is that it just keeps taking this little turn, slight differences, whether it was Civ on Atlantic Records playing hardcore or whether it was Youth of Today on Caroline or, you know, just going to Japan, going to Southeast Asia, just doing different shit. It's fun. It's gotta keep evolving. And so yeah, to answer your question, like 88, it was on like Youth Crew was, yes, you felt it.
I guess going way back to when you first started, did Noise Police ever play like other punk shows other than the sort of this fairy show or the wild sounding, very
Not
punk?
really, except that those guys knew LAB, which was Luke's band, Lukey Luke's band, Loud and Boisterous.
Yeah.
So I remember going out to Brooklyn with those dudes. And I never really went to Brooklyn. I was like 11 and smoking a little pin joint probably with those dudes. But no, I met LAB and I met Luke. And so like that was kind of like, yeah, those guys. It's to point out too is that Toby and Alex from Noise Police later went on to be in the Skedanks.
Oh yeah, the ska band.
Toby changed his name to Rocker T. But Alex grew up on 13th Street. I lived on 15th Street. So, they were older. They knew about hardcore more than I did. But did we play a show? No, we played the Stuyvesant High School, like talent show, the boat show. And definitely the Village Independent Democrats thing, which I have some photos somewhere. It's bugged. Yeah, it's really funny. It was a long time ago.
How much did you have to worry about getting dusted weed back then? Because I know New York was such a dust city and.
Yeah, dust was always the thing you heard about a lot. I think I avoided that. Or like mescaline, like mesc, or like, shitty weed that you buy in Washington Square Park that people would say was like, oregano with roach spray or something. You'd
Yeah.
hear a lot about these things. I mean, I don't think my weed career was that long, really, like looking back. Like it was probably pretty like 6 months maybe, or like a year tops or something. But again, yeah, I was just like young and I was into punk, and so it's just like, let me try this, let me try that. Like we Matt Pincus and I did like Whippets and like, Rush, and it was Yeah, well, I'm glad that I quickly changed gears and met these straight edge dudes and got into that. But yeah, you grow up a little quicker in the city.
Well, yeah, because it gets the other side of New York around that time is getting real heavy with drugs, and there's a real, situation where people start dying years later.
Yeah, I think it was just that innocent, like whatever, innocent drugs. But I mean, for me, I was hanging out at Washington Square Park, skating. That in itself was sort of a melting pot of like downtown kids, graffiti writers with skaters, with punks, with skins. Yeah, I guess going back to the violence that you were talking about before, like there was like people stealing Doc Martens, stealing shoes off people's feet, like that kind of shit. But it was all, yeah, it was all kind of gradual. And yeah, the drug thing, there was like Optimo was like Optimo was like a smoke shop, I guess. And you can go in there, you could buy Rush, you could buy Whippets. I mean, part of it was that this stuff was available to kids. Like you could go and buy alcohol, as a young kid. But I was just attracted to, yeah, being 11 and 10, just like all of it. And like not really knowing, I guess, the differences between GBH and the Bad Brains or something. I just was like, yeah, I'm in, But then I figured it out later.
You know, Whippets are back now, right?
I actually got some email from my daughter's school of like, watch out for Galaxy Gas or something or
Yeah.
some name. And I was just like, oh, I thought Whippets. That was my first thought.
That it's what it is, and it comes with a mouthpiece, and they've gone and flavored it like vapes.
Fucking crazy.
It's like way more nightmarish than just grabbing a can of whipped cream from the store.
Yeah.
It's now it's
But
being.
also, yeah. I mean, they, yeah, scary shit, but, I'm just thinking too, just back then, I had this like that first Murphy's Law record. Like I loved it. I had a cool Murphy's Law t-shirt. I saw Murphy's Law at Irving Plaza. They had this kind of like, yeah, like ganja, reggae, weed, hardcore. The worlds were sort of melting, hip hop a little bit. So it all just blended together, License to Ill, BC. Like it was all just like a whole, it's all coming at me, right? So it was just processing that.
It's a really cool city, I imagine, to grow up in terms of music, because like you're saying, all this stuff is happening on top of each other. Like the same time punk and hardcore exploding, hip hop's obviously exploding. There's also noise rock that's popping off around then too. There's just like it feels like it'd be a really vibrant place to be a young person and a fan of music.
Yeah, and MTV was had kicked off, right? So there's like a little bit of like, holy shit, Billy Idol, like he's got spiked hair, maybe he's punk. Like I think I'm into that, or Flock of Seagulls or whatever. Like there, it was all, yeah. I just and also I really was, my dad plays drums, my grandfather plays drums. I ultimately was into music. Like I was just attracted to that shit too. Of just like I want to fucking rock. Like I said, I was into Kiss earlier on. That was speaking to me, like the idea of playing in a band.
Were your parents into any sort of like punk stuff or like any of that sort of like pre-punk, punk New York rock stuff or like Liquid
Not
Liquid
really.
even?
No, not really. No, I would, that would have been cool. No, my dad came up like in jazz and like a little bit of like Latin music, I guess, and my mom not so much. No, but I guess I had friends' parents. There was a couple of like parents at school in second and third grade. I remember they'd show up and they were fucking pretty out there. You know, like they were like my friend's mother was a photographer that was hanging with Warhol and Basquiat and all that. So there were, and you know, I'd sleep at friends' houses and you could just see like, oh shit, this parent's a little bit cooler. They're into some different shit, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, because like Harley Flanagan's mom famously at the Warhol factory and stuff like that. Like there are this sort of is such a culturally steeped city. And I say this from Toronto, which is like New York with training wheels. So like you kind of have the same thing going on here, but it just feels like, I don't know, maybe it's just the island nature of New York,
Yeah.
Manhattan, and that it feels like it's like everyone's happening on top, everything's happening on top of itself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was like, for me growing up in the village, it felt small and intimate. You know, like I didn't really go above 14th Street. Like I didn't really go to other boroughs. Like I just like the village was like, it was very European. You'd go here to buy your cheese, you go here to buy your fruit. This was the pizza spot. You know people. So there was like, it felt, growing up, like I felt really comfortable, you know. And yeah, there was blocks that you didn't go down, and you know, there was, you learned street smarts and this and that. But yeah, culturally it was a melting pot, so there was a lot of shit. But unfortunately, I mean, I think I was a little young to where I missed, you know. Now it's like, fuck, this was going on. I should have went to like even Danceteria. Like I never went to Danceteria. I did go to Mars, like maybe two or three times. That was a pretty cool club.
What'd you see there?
Mars was just like this nightclub that was like, if I remember correctly, it was like four stories and each floor had its own. It was like, this is the hip hop floor. This is a house floor. The roof was like a metal floor, like they'd play Slayer and shit. And it was just fucking crazy for me, like how I was probably, I don't know, 14 or 15 or something. And so that was, yeah, that was just cool. And like, yeah, I mean, back then, with hip hop too, I got into that and seeing, you know, going to like what the Island Lounge or something and seeing like Poor Wretched's Teachers in KRS-One, or remember at Wetlands like Biz Markie was DJing, or like you just see some of this other shit going on. That was cool. You
Yeah.
know, I was able to jump on that probably a little when I was 16, 17, 18, you know, getting into yeah, and beyond. And so as I got older, I would go to Nell's and yeah, go to different clubs and started to, you know, grow up.
Yeah, like there's Honeychild Coleman was on the podcast and she's talking about getting New York and there's a moment where you've got Basquiat DJing and RuPaul DJing at the same time period,
Yeah.
right? Like this is just what New York nightlife was like.
Yeah, I would go to Nell's. I went downstairs and Prince was there dancing with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
You know, I saw Sid and Nancy, the premiere, I think, at the Ziegfeld, and Andy Warhol was there. Like, yeah, there was all, it was very special, you know. And I think like a lot of cool shit happened just walking down the street. Like I was telling someone the other day how like you know, just you, I remember one time walking to like around Washington Square Park and someone was just like, hey, we're filming this McDonald's commercial, do you want to be in it? And I was like, sure. I think I was a vegetarian at the time, and there was that Terminator to X song, like Buck Wildin. And the word whack was big, and they were like, we just want to ask you a few questions. Like, what do you think about the new McDonald's, blah, blah, blah burger? And I was like, it's whack, man. It's whack. Like, it's Buck Wild and whack. And then they're like, great, awesome. And then they like took my information. They called me, said, like, what does whack mean? I was like, oh, it just means like really exciting and new. And they're like, awesome. And they like paid me a chunk of money. And I don't know if they used it or what, but another time, like, I remember going to see Crocodile Dundee with my friend Cyrus uptown. And it was like summertime. My mom was giving me a lot of shit. Like, you need to get a job. You need to get a summer job. You need to make some money, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, mom, like, whatever. I walk out of the movie theater and this woman's like, hey, I'm doing this article for New York Woman Magazine about city kids. You want to be in it? And I was like, sure. And she's like, cool. You just have to write like this thing about like, you know, growing up in the city. I was like, no problem. So that whole year, and coincidentally, in English class, that was the task, to write the story of your life. So I just handed in my homework to this person. She gave me $1,000 and that I was like, all right, mom, you happy? And I went back to Washington Square Park skating. Like, so these things happen. Like, I was telling someone else's one day. So Bernard Goetz lived across the street from me. Bernard Goetz was the like vigilante dude that had a gun and he was getting robbed and he shot these five black kids. And it was a lot of pushback on him. It was a hot topic in the city, rightfully so. And so this guy, I had a direct view at Bernard Goetz's house. And so this guy buzzed my buzzer. It was like, hey, I'm from the New York Post. Do you mind if I take pictures from your window of Bernard Goetz's thing? I'll pay you. It's like, yes, come up. So this fucking dude, older man, comes into my bedroom with this like long telephoto lens camera and he's shooting Bernard Goetz. And my mom comes home. She's like, Sam, who's that in your bedroom? Oh, don't worry about it, mom. It's New York Times, Daily or New York Post or whatever. So yeah, just shit like that. I don't know if that happens in other cities or the suburbs or Toronto or, but that kind of stuff happened a lot downtown.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems like there's like misadventure and adventure around every corner, especially that time period in New York, like pre-Giuliani New York was, I
Yeah.
guess, di very different.
Koch.
Koch, I guess Koch was the change.
No, Koch was cool, if I
Oh, Koch was
recall.
cool. Okay,
Yeah, the Koch days.
yeah.
No, you're right. Giuliani was definitely the change, or a big part of it. But nothing lasts forever. Like you hear about cities, oh shit, Berlin's having this moment, or Paris, or London, or whatever cities in the US. Like, I think it's only it makes sense. Nothing lasts forever, right? So if you're fortunate enough to be there, like I wasn't around for everything. I missed certain things, but I definitely was there in that those late 80s, which were magical, and the mid 90s were also pretty cool.
Well, there's that have you seen that documentary? I think it's called Beautiful Losers, about like that New York art scene in the early 90s, like pre-Kids, I
Yes.
guess.
Aaron Rose was his name, gallery and all that. I think I feel
Yeah.
like I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah, really interesting documentary, but like I guess that's pre Meet Me in the Bathroom New York. It feels like New York's never not in the zeitgeist by, maybe a year or two off, but then something's happened in New
Yeah.
York again.
Yes. And I'm not like, yeah, it's cool. And there's enough room for everyone to have their shit. I mean, I know for me, like when Kids came out, I was kind of like, I was pre-Kids at Washington Square Park. So that kind of, not that it rubbed me the wrong way, but I just was like, all right, but it's fine. There's always new generations of club kids, graffiti writers, whatever. Like it's evolving and hardcore and punk.
It's weird how big of a cultural moment Kids was, like when it came
Yeah.
out. Like
Yeah.
that's, and it's also like going back and like, it's a very weird, like Lou Barlow doing all the music for it, like Supreme being all over it. Like it's a weird moment of confluence in culture too.
Yeah, I guess it's like timing and that was the right time to kind of wrap it all up into a movie, I guess, and deliver it to, when you put in a film, sometimes it's if it's done right, it's a nice, I guess, like Decline of the Western Civilization too. It's just like, yeah, okay, this is going to be like a template for a lot of people moving forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting how these things become sort of canonized and made into the history or the version of events when people that lived through them seem to have very different takes depending on where they were, like where they came from. Like, Decline of Western Civilization is a great example. Like, how many people have come on here being like, yeah, why wasn't this band on there? Why wasn't that
Right,
band on
right.
there? And
I know it's scary. Like I'm really into what I do. I do for like Revelation Records and Trust Records. I do a lot of like marketing. So it's like storytelling shit, which I love. And I've always had a video camera as a younger. I was always like, let's do a movie, let's do this. But I'm also really hesitant to like do the movie, like do the youth crew of the movie or Straight Edge the movie or whatever it may be, because you just like I don't want to get it wrong. You know what I mean? There's always people in hardcore that are really opinionated, and I guess sometimes they have a right. Like you want to get the story right, but I also appreciate any effort like to do it. At least they try. Whether they didn't nail it, at least they tried. And they got some of it. And but yeah, like someone was saying the other day, someone was talking about like, yeah, there should be what's it called when there's like actors that do the movie like
A
the Joy Division
reenactment.
one,
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
like a
or
biopic type thing.
biopic, yeah, about Straight Edge. And I was kind of like, yeah, but it could really suck, like it's got to be really good.
I would love to see like the biopic of the history of straight edge, just have a camera on Ian MacKaye to watch his reaction when the actor has to come on screen and portray him.
Yes, totally. That would be great.
It would be some fury. That might get a Minor Threat reunion out of it, ultimately.
Yes. Yeah. For sure.
When you first started going to the shows, were there anyone, you know, you don't have to name names of who these people were, but were there people that were like, you were warned about, like, stay away from this dude, that person's like dangerous, like, because you're such a young kid when you're going to these shows, like you're saying, oh, I wish I was at this thing. You would have been like 8 or 9 going to shows if you went any earlier.
Yeah, I mean, they were all, like I said earlier, like they were all like superheroes, like they were giant people, like the Purcell, the photograph of Purcell on the back of Breakdown the Walls, like he's fucking giant. So to me, like at that time, Gavin, Pete Sick of It All, Purcell, you know, Harley, Tommy Carroll, like these guys were all giant superheroes, you know, and I would just like kind of look up to them, I guess. And but I definitely, you know, I knew that, yeah, some of them were known for fighting and were maybe, and then, you know, I'd hear stories of sort of pre my time of like 8 Ball in a Sock running down Avenue A, like kind of from certain people. And, you know, definitely, yeah, stories of a little bit before my time. So I would, yeah, I guess I just, yes, I definitely had my street smarts, my wits about me, but, yeah, no one, trying to think of like, I mean, again, like later when it got like more violent, it was just like, yes, I'm leaving this place. You know, some, you smell in the air, some shit's going to happen. But in that, like, you know, especially the Anthrax, like that was like our clubhouse. It was cool. You know, we were, but yeah, the Pyramid Club, I guess, like, I remember Krishna Mike, you know, just like fucking going off moshing and just caught me in the eye. I mean, whether it was an accident or not, but like, you know, there was dudes that were just older and rougher than me, for sure, or than most people.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And there were definitely shows you guys played with bands in other places that were pretty wild, like Boom and the Legion of Doom in Detroit, where they had the Dead Deers.
Yeah.
Infamously, I guess, is that show? There's a video of it on stage where they're throwing dead deer guts around.
That might have been 80, the year before me in 87.
Maybe it's the 87 tour.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, to those guys' credit, Youth of Today, like that 80s shit was more wild the previous year, right? So I toured the US in 88, but they had done it already in 87. And I think right in 85, maybe there was the Can't Close My Eyes tour. So some of the groundwork was laid there. I remember actually at Detroit was like, there was a place called Blondie's and that we would play in Detroit. And I remember like, I guess we were coming up from the South because we bought all these fireworks. And the next day we were maybe going to Canada and we had to get rid of the fireworks. So Purcell and Luke and I, in this pretty fucked up neighborhood, must have been around Blondie's, like in the middle of the day, had this bottle rocket, Romy Candle war fight. And a couple of kids from the neighborhood came out. That was pretty wild. But yeah, like just to, you know, like I was saying earlier, there was, you know, pockets of Nazi skins down south, and there was, you know, fights. There was a fight in Houston. There were, but maybe by 88 in the US at least, like there was, I mean, there was a lot of straight edge kids too, I guess, youth crew kids, or enough to help us out to make it work, you know? But I think, well, I would say this about the violence or like the, some of that shit is that I had these older dudes with me, right? So like Steve Reddy from that band Wolfpack from Equal Vision Records, he was our roadie. I was 14. He was probably 21 or something. And he, you know, grew up he could fight, right? So
the youth crew enforcer, I think, is the
yeah,
nickname.
Like yeah, Steve and you know, and Capo and some of these guys were like, they were on the front lines, right? Not to say that I was totally aloof, but I just didn't have that same weight on my shoulders that I think these guys did. You know, of reading the room, of really know what's going on. I was playing drums and trying to work on my mosh beat.
Well, you know, I'm getting into this stuff at 15, but now that I have a 15-year-old, it seems way wilder to me that you're 15 years old going on these tours and doing this kind of stuff. Like at the time it was like a fantasy thing, like, oh, I could totally handle it. But now I look at, and no disrespect to my 15-year-old, he's amazing, but I look at a 15-year-old,
yeah,
like, and I look at my lifestyle as a 45-year-old touring in a band, and I'm like, I don't think I'm even equipped yet to really deal with this lifestyle, let alone at 15 trying to do it.
I think it was a lot, like maybe you can relate to this, as because I have a 15, she'll be 15 in a month or two. But like, and my mom said this too, like, and she, there was some interview she did, my mom, again, another weird New York thing. I think it was just like CBS News, like Sunday afternoon, had this like, we're going to deep dive with a New York kid. And I was one of them. And so they interviewed my mom, and it's pretty cool. I have it somewhere on VHS if it's still alive, but it's got some cool footage. But she basically said, look, you know, he could be on a school bus on the football team, you know, driven by some drunk bus driver, or the coach is some who knows what, or the other kids or who knows what, and blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of how I feel like she might have justified it. Like, she knew all the kids. We were all straight edge. They were older, responsible-ish. And it made sense for her. So for me as a parent, though, like right now, it's a lot of like, what are you doing after school? What are your electives? Yeah. Like, what are your, are you into sports? Like, your friends are into sports. Are you into art? Like, what are you into? So maybe this was at 15, 16, something that you're just kind of into and therefore supportive of. The part that's more wild is like the 11, 12, 13 years.
Yeah.
You know, 15 yeah. seems a little bit like it's young, but all right, you're 15, you're doing shit, whether you're on the football team or whether you're playing CBs. But when I look back at like those Noise Please, you know, being Grilled Biscuits in 85, so I was 12, right? Like,
yeah.
That shit's young.
I got a 12. I've got a 12-year-old now, and she plays drums. And yeah, that blows my fucking mind. Like, just yeah. Like, wait a sec. Like,
my daughter did School of Rock. She plays bass, and you know, they play real clubs at the end of School of Rock. So that she's played like the Troubadour and like, you know, certain places in LA where we live. And it's cool. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems crazy. Yes, if she had taken the path I did, you know, I don't know. You go with your gut as a parent. And I think my parents kind of just, like I said earlier, it happened sort of gradually, quickly, but gradually. And it kind of evolved in a natural way.
Yeah. Like, I have a lot of respect for parents that are able to get out of themselves enough and support their kids in doing that. Like Lil Joe from RKL, which a terrifying band to think of a 15-year-old kid being in on tour, but ultimately that's his life's path. Like, to be a parent and to see it in your kid and be like, I'm going to support you because, you know, look at you, like, this is what my child is destined to do. And I'm going to let go of my hangups and my bullshit and let them live their lives. Like, I hope that I have that wherewithal with my kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan of being present and communicating, you know, so with my kid or with anything in life. And I think that's kind of how my parents were too. So it's just when you know, you sniff it out, you know, like, all right, this scene is not cool, or this kid's not cool, or everything's fine, you know, or it seems fine at least. And so that's been kind of working for me.
Do you think it would have been different if your parents had met like Vinny, Rat Bones, and like, you know, it's like, I'm trying to think of a third person to put in that trio. Like, I'm just thinking there's like very positive presenting people that you're hanging out with versus the people that you're at shows with who are, you know, ultimately great people, but a little freakier, I imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember Billy Bitter, the bass player for Side by Side, who was older and bigger, a big Billy Bitter. He lived on Pitt Street, which was really fucked up back then. And he broke his leg or knee or something, and he couldn't walk up the stairs. So my mom said, hey, you could stay at our house. And so like, that was, you know, Billy was super sweet, but it was just like, it was holy shit. Okay. Big fucking, this big skinhead is staying at my house with his broken leg. You know, my mom was cool with that. And, you know, so, you know, like Gavin, just like there was, like you were saying earlier about like older kids, like, yeah, there was older kids hanging out of the house. Like I'm 14 and these guys are, 18, 19, 20. But yeah, she met some of those guys. I don't know. It's interesting. My sister, maybe she was just more secretive about it, but she wasn't really into like the New York hardcore scene, but she did kind of tap into for like briefly tapped into like who was the band? Maybe Scab or like just certain like female fucking very rough girls of the LES that my sister like kind of briefly was kicking it with. And I don't know if my parents knew about that or not, but when I look back, I was like, that's I'm always more I should ask her about that. I'm always more curious, like, what the fuck, how did you tap into that? Oh, I knew there was this one friend that knew them, so that's probably how. But and yeah, what was that like for her? Like it just seems, I don't know, she doesn't strike me as the type of person to be kicking it at the Pyramid or A7 or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's interesting how people fall into these scenes sometimes. And I guess like that's the thing in in a place like New York, there's stuff always happening. Like you could always, it seems like there's a lot of like were there kids in your high school that were into this stuff that like, weren't necessarily part of your peer group that would recognize you from shows and like was it like that kind of thing or was it still very niche and underground?
I think there was older kids that like knew about like a little sliver of it, so they would maybe like know about something more mainstream, like, oh shit, they know about Minor Threat or the Circle Jerks or or just like there was definitely the older kid who was like, well, this kid's kind of cool, he's into hip hop or yeah, like certain elements of hardcore, but not really the grit, not straight ahead, not an altercation, not beyond demo, like kind of knew about like, yeah, the larger side of it. But yeah, there was not
You just
my
dropped the New York hardcore nerd cannon right there with those three.
because it's niche, right? It's
Very
very
niche,
like
yeah.
when you especially when I was into it on that level, it was like I've got the Altercation demo and the YDL demo and something else demo and I'm going to Giant Studios and I'm like, I'm just like fucking in it. This is 100% what I'm into. So I don't think there were kids in my school, older kids that really knew about like the nuanced elements of it. I mean, for me, this one school was my friend Matt Pincus. There was Philip Glass's son, Zach Glass,
Oh,
went
he's
to
a
my
hardcore kid?
school. He was punk. He was more punk.
Oh, wow.
Not really hardcore, but like punk. So we were relate on that level. And his sister and some of her friends were like a little more punk, but more new wave. There was like, okay, you guys are new wave. You're into The Cure, Depeche Mode, or something. Then there was a couple ska kids that like New York had a sort of, what was the, there's some like,
Toasters, Moon
yeah, like the
Ska.
Toasters and the Boilers. And there was a second step. And there was like a New York ska scene that was kind of like also coming up. That sort of rubbed shoulders with the hardcore scene a little bit, like at least from my perspective. So there was those kids that I would kind of, so we're all sort of under the same umbrella, but as it's like there's all these subdivisions for better or for worse. Like I know about the Together 7-inch, you guys don't.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Chris Minacucci from Radio Raheem's zine that he did with Chris Corey of unreleased New York hardcore demos or unheard New York hardcore demos? Them theor It's them theorizing on what various hardcore demos that they were never able to actually hear might sound like at different times. It's
Oh, that's interesting.
unbelievable. I'll send you I'll send you some photos of it later on. It's
Yeah,
awesome.
yeah.
The level of minutia people go into with New York hardcore stuff is incredible, like the granular knowledge people have of different lineups and different recordings and sessions. It's a religion. People obsess over it.
Yeah, the soundboards from CBs, I guess maybe hopefully my memory isn't better than with the reality, but I remember them being really good. Like I know Luke's got a few. I remember having like a Mayhem cassette soundboard, a couple of them that were really cool.
I got an amazing Mayhem show at CB's where Dan Lilliker gets up and does something with them or and they sent it to the guys from the band MSI from Toronto. I think back then they were in DOG, Death of Gods, and I inherited it somehow. So yeah, I'm a big fan of the New York City Mayhem, New York City Mayhem, sorry, I guess.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always looking, like, again, with the stuff I do with Revelation and with trust, it's like, what needs to come out, or what has, I mean, it's hard these days because everything's out in some, YouTube or whatever, but it's like, yeah, what's that demo? Someone was talking about the Judge demo to me the other day, and like, does that need to come out? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't think everything needs to come out, but hopefully good shit.
Yeah, it's interesting how we live in this era where everything does have to come out now. Like, there's that Stooges box set, right? Of Funhouse, Complete Funhouse, where it's every time they press record, And I made a playlist one time, and it's 26 versions of I Gotta Write by the Stooges, just like aborted attempts and things like that. We live in this era where people want that kind of, like, it's. Everything's so broad that the people that choose to get into something, I guess, want to get as deep into something as you possibly get.
I
This
guess it depends on like
podcast.
what format, maybe like
Yeah.
a vinyl pressing of that for the collectors that want it. Great. But like on streaming on DSPs, like I don't know if I want five versions of The Storm by Judge. Like I want you to hear the best version. Like I don't think you need to hear the demo and the rehearsal and the chunking even or whatever. So it's like putting your best foot forward because yeah, thinking about it, like if you're 13 years old and you're exploring, hey, I want to know what's up with whatever, side by side. Like, I don't want you to hear the fucking rehearsal of Backfire. I want, we have one, yeah, the good version or.
That Revelation CD that came out, it has like tons of versions of different songs, right? Demos and stuff on the side by side one, right?
Well,
Late
we've been sort
90s.
of we've been kind of peeling those back a little bit. Like
Okay.
that's when it was like all about the CD and the discography and put as much shit on as possible.
Yeah.
And then now we've been sort of because the, streaming wasn't really a thing then. So now with streaming, it's like, okay, why, like why is this wrong? Like this isn't the right artwork for this record. Why is this like weird discography Judge cover? It should be the fucking cover, So part of what I'd like to do is just like get back to the side by side cover is an example. Like I think it used to be this discography cover and now it's the three dudes as it should be.
I think we could probably blame that on that Grand Theft Audio Agnostic Front CD, right? The United Blood Complete Sessions, where they had rehearsals, they had every single thing. Oh, I guess also Lost and Found, who you've been bootlegged many times by, they would put tons of shit out there too. I remember
I think it was
demos
the
and all
thing,
that.
the discography. It was just like record labels, yes, trying to make money, but also that was the thing of like, it's a CD. You could put a lot, there's more room, right? So you could put lots of shit on it. Therefore, let's do it. But yeah.
You mentioned earlier watching MTV and seeing Billy Idol and wondering if he was punk. I think much in the same way, Jordan Knight and the New Kids on the Block shirt,
Yes.
one of the most mind-blowing factoids that got passed around in the pre-internet world, I think, amongst fans. How did that come about? Was it through EK from Warzone? Because I know he had a band with Jordan Knight called Miracle Boy, right? Like a punk band.
Right. I'd heard that EK was in New Kids for a second too. That would be a logical answer, although I feel like that design was the one design that maybe got like licensed and it was at, I mean, it was pretty hot topic, but it was like sort of like the mainstream design. So I would have to guess like it was more of a stylist or I don't know. I don't think I never heard anything that he was like a real fan or that EK gave it to him. I feel like I would have heard that story. No, but I will say this about yeah, that Youth Today shirt, the New Kids video. It's like hardcore has this weird, it's sort of the, for me, it's like this fun side story that every so often just keeps popping up where you'll see like, the other day, Travis Scott, the rapper, wore a Judge shirt. Probably because his stylist gave it to him or something like that. But you'll see these little moments where like civilians get part of hardcore shit and you, it's funny. I think it's just interesting.
It is interesting. It always like blows my mind because then it becomes like, well, how did this get there? And I'm always fascinated by the journey that something has, like, the sparkly silver SSD shirt that Chris Novoselic wears on the Saturday Night Live performance, right? Or like, how did this shirt show up on Travis Scott? Like, it made the movie Made, where Vince Vaughn's wearing the America's Hardcore shirt in the opening sequence. Like, those are what I
Or
live
what's
for.
the Amazon what was the movie where the guy, the drummer who lost his hearing recently?
Oh yeah, Yeah.
I'll like fix a metal this drummer.
Intro. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But he had that Youth Today sweatshirt like in the whole movie, which was pretty cool.
I think there were hardcore kids involved in the production of that movie.
Yeah.
And that
Yes. I knew this one kid who I think taught him how to play drums or something. But you know, there's always like those moments of when your scene just kind of creeps out into different ways. Just thinking about that movie, The Beat, you know, when they filmed the Cro-Mags were in it. But then I was also in it, but I was in like a different scene on a different day. I went to like with Matt Dillon's brother and like, so being, holy shit, I'm like a hardcore kid, but I'm in this movie that's kind of bugged out. Or, you know, Purcell was an extra in some Alan Alda film. Just like all the, it's always a trip whenever you, or yeah, like just even I was in, Dieter Ramone's rap video. That was another like New York moment where I was like just sitting with my friend Max on 8th Street between 5th and 6th. And Chris Williamson was like, yo, what are you guys doing at 1 o'clock? You know, Beat the Arch, Washington Square Park. So, all right, show up. And then fucking Dieter Ramone comes out and he's filming his. So, you know, anytime you could just like, you know, it was pre-internet, right? Pre-Instagram, pre all that shit. So holy shit, I'm on MTV. I'm on, you know, in a movie or whatever. It was a bigger deal, I guess, back then. Or yeah, to see Lee Ving, like that always was like, holy shit, Lee Ving from fucking Fear is in Flashdance. I'm fucking psyched.
Yeah, no, it's still a big deal when you see this stuff. You know, it's still like, you know, it's still always like interesting. It still makes people on the internet get upset and freak. Like, why is Billie Eilish wearing a confused patch? Like,
right.
I'm more like, oh, isn't it funny? Isn't it interesting that there's like Infest stickers in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
Yes.
Like
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It'll always be interesting. I like, or Friends, the show Friends, there's a Shelter Doggy Dog poster in the background of one of the people who's post that image. And
Andrew, who was the executive producer on Friends for the last 4 or 5 seasons, just did the Red Cross documentary. And I have been told has a complete collection of Maxim Rock and Rolls.
Oh shit.
So there is a punk connection on Friends right there.
Yeah. That's also cool is, you know, some of the hardcore comrades who end up in the professional world, you know, if it's a music supervisor. So now you're getting, you know, whatever hardcore dudes are scoring shit and being in commercials. I think it was like our friend Marco Siega, who did the Civ video, Can't Wait 1 Minute More, went on to do a lot of like TV shows and stuff. And I think he's put some hardcore songs in shows. And actually Marcos, this was funny too. I was thinking about this the other day, but Marcos was doing a commercial for Preferred Stock, which is what, like a deodorant or something.
Okay.
Yeah. And he asked Walter if he wanted to write the jingle. And they said they wanted to be like, Hey Jealousy. Was that the Gin Blossoms?
Yeah. Or, yeah. Hey Jealousy. Yeah, that's right.
Hey Jealousy. So that was the creative brief. And so basically Walter wrote a jingle and Arthur and I played on it and we recorded Don Fury's. And I don't know if he got it or not, or if it ended up going through, but like, you know, when you have, yeah, hardcore dudes that are in the civilian real world, I guess it's funny shit can happen.
Oh yeah. What were your thoughts when Dee Dee Ramone came out rapping? Like, did you know that that was the direction he was going to go in, or you just like slack?
I don't know if like you could hear the song really when he was doing it. I guess he was playing it on that boombox or something and just dancing around. I think I was more just like, oh, this is funny. There were some other skinheads there. My friend Kyle was there and, you know, a couple people. And, but no, I didn't really, it didn't really strike me at the time that, you know, this is Dee Dee from the Ramones and now he's doing rap. But looking back, like, I love that time of, you know, punk and hip hop and the successes and the failures, right? You know, like, I mean, the Clash were kind of, you know, playing in it, and Blondie was, and, you know, Dee Dee was, and it's funny. I'm wearing I have a shaved head. I'm wearing a red, like, U.S. Marines shirt. I was in my skinhead
year. I gotta go back and watch it. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm definitely gonna go. Gives me an excuse to revisit the best period of Dee Dee Ramone's career.
Check it out.
Yeah, I think we can all safely say that. Going back to what you said though about like hardcore showing up in hardcore places, like, yeah, Elgin James, who does the Mayans.
Yes.
In Forced Reality back then, back in the day in Connecticut. like all the time there's punk stuff showing up there. And he had Alice Bag in an episode this season. You know, he's put like a bunch of punk rockers in the show too. And it's like, oh, I mean,
it makes sense because it's good. I mean, it's the coolest shit, right? Like, so if it's, you know, if it fits whatever you're doing to be able, I think it gives you an edge in life, you know, like it's funny how when I moved to LA like 12 years ago, a friend of mine was like, hey, do you want to work at this advertising company? And that's what brought me out here. My daughter was two and I was like, fuck, I need a job. And it was like a real job. And, you know, there was it was some pretty mainstream clients. And there was a moment where I was like, fuck, I'm out of my element. This is crazy. What am I doing here? And then I kind of made the connection like, okay, this is all like, you know, branding and experiential and events. And basically like I got the best education in that. Like we put on shows, you know, I've seen events go wrong and go right. I've been to shitty festivals. And I've been to good ones. And I've like, and that Youth Today Fist, whether you like it or not, is the ultimate branding, or that GB logo, or, you know, whatever it is, the Rev logo. So like, you know, and storytelling and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, back to what, to be older and in whatever, a real job, but to have these hardcore chops under your belt is, it gives you an edge, you know? And if you're in a position where you can connect the dots and like reference, you know, bands or people or whatever, help them out, it's cool.
Well, and look how much pop culture has kind of followed the lead, like zines, mosh pits, like the idea of being proudly DIY. Like these are all
totally
conventions, right? Like,
yep. Totally.
These things might have existed before punk, but like we're the ones that really branded this shit.
Yes. Yeah, for real. For real. So it was comforting.
Well, speaking of punk showing up in weird places, I got to ask you about one of the most mind-blowing things I've ever seen on the internet.
Yes.
A couple months ago, actually like a year and a half ago, Emissions Records put up a post promoting the reissue of Side by Side that Revelation had done on pink vinyl. Months later, there is one comment put on this post from an actor by the name of Jerry O'Connell, saying, attention, Sammy, you are getting love in Toronto, and a bunch of emojis. And you responded with a bunch of emojis back to him, or a fist bump emoji back to him.
Uh-huh.
That has blown my mind and all of my friends in various group chats. This thing has been distributed in mind since it happened, including the people from Emissions Records. What's the fucking deal? Is he like a fan of Side by Side?
He was the sickest mosher, dude, in the world. He would fucking go nuts. No, I'm just kidding. No, I can help here. So 88, Youth of Today, we're on tour around the US. Come back. I was going to a school called McBurney, which was like this private school that had moved buildings. Richie Birkenhead went there. He was a little older. I think Adam Horowitz went there. He was older. My mom's like, hey, your school went out of business. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? How does a school go out of business? But it went out of business. So we're sort of scrambling. I had like a week to go. And my friend Molly Rubin, her older sister, Sarah Rubin, is the girl on the cover of the Way It Is record with the blonde hair cut up by the drums. So Molly, Sarah's sister, went to this school called PCS. It was Professional Children's School on 60th in Amsterdam. So I was like, well, Molly goes to this school. Why don't we check it out? So we went to visit it. It was cool. Like I could get in. And next thing you know, I'm going to PCS, which was for like a lot of, it was a small private school for a lot of like professional kids. So it would allow you to go on correspondence. So it would allow you to not really go to school and just have a tutor, I guess, if you're on set. Like the Cosby kids went there, but I would never see them. Macaulay Culkin went there, but I would never see him. But Jerry O'Connell went there and I would see Jerry all the time because he, you know, he worked, but not enough to keep him out of school, I guess. And of course he was the kid from Stand By Me. So Jerry and I hung out. He was chill. Like we were in the same class together. So I'd see him a lot. So that's that kind of Jerry connection. You know, we went to high school together.
Did you ever bring him to shows?
No, not really. I don't know what, if he knows really about hardcore much now, but he's big on Instagram and he just comments on my shit a lot. And I run into him every once in a while. He's a good dude. Another one from that is this kid, Donald Faison, who's in that show. It's a big show.
Oh yeah, Donald Faison. I definitely know that guy.
Maybe research it after the show, but it's like there's a doctor in it. They're like doctors and someone else really famous is in it. It's a TV show. But he was in my class too. And then my girlfriend was this girl, Holly Combs, who later went on to be one of the witches on Charmed.
Oh, whoa. Yeah, yes. I don't definitely know Donald Faison now. I'm looking up.
What's the show that Donald was on?
He was on that show Scrubs.
Yes, exactly. And he's always in like commercials and shit. So like, you know, I was, it was a cool that school was kind of bugged out because there was a lot of kids that were sort of, very famous and then like loosely famous. I remember walking by Carnegie Hall one day after school and seeing this girl from my class. Like, I think her name was Midori. She was like a violinist, like some sick, just like Midori tonight at Carnegie Hall. I was like, oh my God, you're the fucking, you're the kid from, history class.
Well, my connection to Jerry O'Connell is, I think around that time or shortly thereafter, he moves to Toronto to do a TV show called My Secret Identity, which my best friend's mom was the producer of. So I met him around then, as a little kid. Like I would have been
because 10. Toronto was big filming stuff.
Yeah, we're New York with training wheels. We're New York with training wheels in every way. So we can pretend to be you guys,
I like Toronto. I have a lot of, although it's one of these places, every time I go, it's like a fully different city. I can't really get a feel for it. Like one day, last time I was there, it was freezing, raining, gray. Everything seemed kind of fucked up. I was like, what is up with the city? And then I've had other moments where it's like, there's a park and I'm chilling. It's beautiful and there's good food. And it just depends on, I guess the different experiences. I think I was there with 7 Seconds on that Circle Jerks Negative Approach tour.
Yeah, I missed that because I was away during that show. But Toronto's a city where it hates itself. It's definitely a city that's also governed by the suburbs. And so there's not a lot of respect for the culture and the history of the city. Like we'll pave over and put a condo over anything, like everyone talks about CBGBs and the closing of CBGBs and lamenting that, but like, at least it's still there in some form. Like we would have raised that thing and put a condo over top of it, which I guess would happen in Brooklyn during that sort of wave of gentrification.
Yeah. Like Queen Street, that stuff. I feel like I'm always in that area. I don't know. I like it. I guess I don't know. I need to go more.
Were you first here with Youth of the Day?
I think we must have in 88. I know that there was I feel like there was a, yes. Cause I remember going over the border and talking about that.
Maybe it was Straight Ahead here. There's a Youth of the Day Straight Ahead show that happens at the Bridge, I believe was the name of the venue. I only know this because I have a flyer. But
I think we were stuck on the border or something happened. We were stuck on the border and we were exhausted. And a bunch of us fell asleep inside this or we're hanging out in this donut shop, probably like a Timmy Hortons or something like that. But Luke, who was our roadie on that tour in 88, went across the street to a mattress store and got into a fucking bed and went to sleep and woke up and was surrounded by all the employees. And went running out.
So who would you hang out with mainly on those tours? Because you are kind of the youngest guy there. Luke closest to you, I guess?
Luke's closest to me in age for sure. But we would all, Purcell was like my older brother. Purcell and I were really tight. So he was my dude. Like he and I were just like bros. And then like Alex Brown and Ray Kappa were like my older brothers who I'd kind of fight with and who else? Yeah, like Walter and we were all like in it, and depending on how long it was, the more insane we would get and like start drawing on each other while we're sleeping and, pranks and shit.
Well, especially because European tours can be very isolating, I find, because you're with your band, but like it's not, it just feels different, especially because they're normally longer too. So I imagine that would have been wild to be on.
Well, Europe was, so I was going to that school. I was on correspondence. So what happened at that school coincidentally was I started and I was like, okay, this is cool. I'm going to this weird, like professional school, but I'm not really professional. Sure enough, that school year, Youth Today got this 2-month tour in Europe. So it's February and March. Any other school, I would have been left back, but because I was allowed to go on correspondence, I took my work with me. I would like have to FedEx it back. But, I was like learning about, the Nazis and shit. And I was able to go to Dachau and visit, or we went or the Roman Empire and I'm in Rome or this was real hands on. But that tour in 89, it was like 2.5 months long. Like it was amazing. One of my favorite tours ever, but it was fucking crazy. Like that could be a movie in itself. Probably like 80% of the shows were squats. We totally got ripped off, made no money. We were on tour with the band called Lethal Aggression, who were New Jersey drug corps. Sometimes we played 2 shows in one day. Some of the shows were fucking, empty. We're like 5 or 6 people, like GIs, just like really weird. Other shows were packed, like 1,000 kids. It was like an airport hangar or something. It was just really, yes, very raw, very punk. other shows were just like all Nazi skins, and then there was like pockets of straight edge and shit. And but you know, Ray, to his credit, Capo, like he, our singer, had the ability to really turn any fucking show into a special show, whether it was going to be a funny one or an angry one or whatever. It was always like we left our mark, and they were all special.
That's what everyone kind of says, that like there was just no one else. You know, HR obviously is like an incredible front person that no one's of his kind of like level, but in the same way, Ray Capo is like an incredible front person that no one's really able to kind of do what he's was able to do in a room.
I agree. I mean, he's like, he was fucking nuts, like really special, and just like, yeah, the ability to turn any show into a great show. And then just like, yeah, like he, his style and the, and just to bring it, and the shit he would say in between songs was really inspiring. And it still is today when we play. Like, part of the reason why we do it is because it's still good. And the shit he talks about in between songs, and the kind of fire that he still has, like, it's different, but it works.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember going to see them on, it would have been Better Than a Thousand, on that Revelation tour that happened. Yeah. And going down there, and there's like this guy who's like an older punk from here, who Sandy, the bass player of my band before we were in a band together, was interviewing him for a zine. And this guy, you know, had to like hijack the interview to scream at him about Krishna and how mad he was about Krishna stuff. And this is like, you know, how many years after that? At that point,
yeah.
And I'm like, he probably still has to take shit from people about straight edge, about Krishna. Like every night, there's probably someone that's like 40 years ago.
I think there's something real about creative things that like, you know, evoke that feeling of like, I love this or I fucking hate this. And Ray had that. It was never just like middle of the road responses. It was always like, I love this or I fucking hate this guy. For some reason, he was hated a lot, you know, and he just, because whatever reason, people felt threatened or whatever it may be. But to bring out that emotion is like, I think that's a good thing. You know, it's special.
Oh, it's amazing. I always tell Walter, like, one of my favorite things ever in hardcore is the fact that Jamie Josta said that Hatebreed was inspired by his hatred of Quicksand. And that's why he wanted to do Hatebreed. And I'm like, and I think Walter was like a little like, why do you think that's so great? And I'm like, uh-huh. Oh, you're inspiring with both swings of the sword. Like, not everyone's going to like your music, and that yeah. should never be the goal. Yeah. But if you're still able to elicit that kind of response by not saying something offensive, but just making music that someone disagrees with, that's like, right. Wow, like that you succeeded on both levels.
I mean, Mike with Judge talks about wanting to quit Youth of Today to start Judge because he wanted to just be even more fucking unapologetic, straight edge, in your face, like harder stance on it, I guess. And that's kind of what inspired him. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I never knew that about Hatebreed, though. That's funny. They wanted to just be heavier, like fuck, this isn't heavy. I want to be heavier.
So what he, I think it's in Victory magazine issue number 2.
Yeah.
He's like, someone played me Quicksand and told me that that was what hardcore was. And got I was it. So mad that I wanted to go out and make something that was just the opposite sounding of it. And he's like,
yeah,
the first Hatebreed demo is basically grind because I wanted to be just diametrically opposed to it. And that's a great yeah. thing, right? Like, cause we can all be involved in punk and hardcore and we're not all going to sound the same. How boring would it be? Fucking
sure. Be? For sure. And it's cool how looking back, and I'm sure now too, of just how quickly it was like just ricocheting off each other. Like I was thinking a lot about those kind of 7 Seconds New Wind and like the Bold 7-inch and like even that second Uniform Choice album, like when shit just kind of got like melodic and a little softer. Like, yeah, that was just a reaction to, you know, the previous thing. And also just where you're at in your life, you know, the difference from say 19 to 21, and I only know how to play these chords, but now I know how to play these chords. I know, I, you know, I can now play a different beat, or I'm comfortable playing slower or whatever the fuck it is. Like,
I don't think I accepted and found love in my heart for that second Uniform Choice LP until I had been in a band for more than 5 years and realized uh-huh. like, you why would you want to do the same thing over and over again? And obviously there's yeah. bands that did succeed in doing that, but like the yeah. reality is like, that's kind of disingenuous a lot of times because it's just like, you're not going to be that person forever.
And I get it for the listener too. Like, you don't know, like, so going back to 89 Youth Today, I joined Youth Today in 87, right into 88. Now it's 89. I'm in Europe. I love Youth Today. I was a fan of the band before I joined it. It's 89. Our singer's got a fucking Hare Krishna Sika And he's basically not staying with us every night. He's going to the Christian temple, staying with devotees, showing up with devotees. And I was like, what the fuck, man? I was took offense to it. I was pissed off, right? So because I wanted Youth Today straight edge, let's go. Thinking straight break down the walls, it's fucking let's go. But as an adult now looking back, I fully understand. Like the dude started Youth Today in 85. So you change, you know, you're so at that point he was, you know, morphing into what then became I guess that, you know, Shelter and other chapters of his life. So yeah, you it's harder to grasp, you know, at a younger age back then, pre-web, pre-socials, you know, you get into Uniform Choice, you're like, I'm psyched. I just found out about this band. Okay, holy shit, they're staring to the sun. I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like as a young kid getting into it, younger than them, you don't realize how big that 3-year gap would have been for them, or that 2-year gap right. would have been for them as people and as young adults growing up. And yeah, like I really, you gain a new understanding and a new appreciation for different people's situations as you get older. And like looking back on it, the amount of insecurity that kind of goes into people's reactions sometimes to these changes. And
it's also like, I think as a band member too, you're more precious about it back then and drawing lines. And I'm not that anymore. I'm this. I'm not now. Now I'm this. I'm not that. Whereas now, like when we play with rival schools, it's been like 25 years or something, or Shelter, you know, it's like, it's okay. Like we might play, I don't know, like we might just do this or that, like musically, like it's fine. Whereas back then it was more like, I have to stop this to start that. We're breaking up because I'm doing this. I'm no longer in that band. I'm in this band. I'm going solo, whatever the fuck it is. Whereas now it's just like, it's all good.
But that was almost brilliant marketing for you guys, right?
That's
like, and I think you see it with bands now where it's a lot more cynical when bands do break up and like, yeah, we're broken up. And then 2 years later, it's like,
yeah,
we're back and bigger than ever.
No, you're right. That's a good point. It's the ultimate limited edition. It's the ultimate like, you have to see this. They're coming to your town and they might never come to your town again. You know, although I feel that way now too, though, I'm thankful that a lot of my bands still get to play, but you know, it's every show could be the last one. So it's like, I don't know.
Well, that's the thing is like when you come back eventually and it does have that kind of like, well, this might be the last time you see this person. Like, I'm not going to name names, but I went to Punk Rock Bowling and there was definitely someone I saw get up on stage and I'm like, I'm very grateful that I'm able to see them perform like this. Cause I don't know how long they're going to be able to perform like this, just the reality of life and getting older. Even at this point, I'm amazed they're able to perform like this.
Yeah.
And I feel like, but there is this sort of like, you need to tell people that it's gone forever. Like I remember the excitement, and this is a very small time, but around that first Youth of the Day reunion in Connecticut and just like everyone freaking out being like, it's back. Like talk about hell freezes over with the Eagles. Like this was the hell freezes over for me and my friends.
Right. Yeah. The timing it's, there's certain moments where like it all, it was this right timing, just like, I guess like Have Heart playing that show. I wasn't there, but it was like 10,000 people or something. Like, that's just like, you nailed it. That's the right time for the right band at the right place. And that's, you know, when you can get that, it's not always that easy to do, but it's if you can. But yeah, that show was fucked up. That Connecticut one was the one that, speaking about Jamie, and he did that. The place was oversold or something, so we ended up having to play two shows in one day. And then like tried to get paid, and I couldn't find him. And I remember like going to his house. It was like a whole fucking
thing.
A very long day.
Yes. I didn't get to go to the show, but it lives on very much in memories. And I think there's VHS copies of that floating around, certainly on the tape trading circuit. It was like the high point of tape trading. Well, Sam, I could keep you forever and talk to you forever, but I don't want to keep you all day because
this was a lot of fun. This was cool. Thank you.
Before you go though, I got to ask you, what was it like playing with Patti Smith?
I was pretty bugged out. Talking about Lenny K and shit, that was fun. Well, so I went to, back to that school, that professional children's school. I went to school with this kid named Oliver Ray. Oliver ended up dating Patty. I don't know if they're still together now, but they were like a thing for a while. I lived on McDougal Street in Bleecker. Patty lived down the block of McDougal. So I would see them all the time. And, you know, she wouldn't really say much. I just thought, oh my God, it's Patty Smith. Although I wasn't a huge Patty Smith fan. I definitely knew who she was. Anyway, one day Oliver's like, hey, our drummer, we have some benefit we have to do. Our drummer's like, you know, on a family vacation or something, can't do it. Do you want to do it? She was like, sure. So we went and we rehearsed. And like, you know, I thought, like, I grew up downtown playing drums. I thought I knew every fucking rehearsal studio. Sure enough, there's like some secret, like Soho, you know, only Patti Smith type people know about it, you know, rehearsal room that was awesome. Rehearsed. It's cool. I learned the songs. And then that morning, Oliver picked me up, like, all right, hey, let's go. We're gonna go pick up Lenny. I was like, okay, cool. We'll go to St. Mark's Place right by where Sounds used to be. And sure enough, Lenny Kaye comes down. He's like got this instrument in this case. He's like, Oliver, this is this oud that I got in India. And Oliver's like, oh, great, cool. And like, I'm in the back seat. Lenny gets in shotgun. Oliver closes the door, snaps the neck on the fucking oud.
Oh, no.
Right? So, and Lenny was just chill, like, that's okay, Oliver. Anyway, we drive to it was at Washington Irving High School, the benefit, and we drive there and we play. And you know, I did it. It was cool. I kind of feel like I've, you know, not that if I could do that one over, I would have liked to have done it over. Like I feel like I played it like a young hardcore drummer in a way, like too fast, too heavy. I wish I was more chill and groovy, but I never really heard any complaints from them, and it happened. Yeah, I have the set list somewhere. It's cool.
Who's easier to rehearse with and play with, Fred Durst or Patti Smith?
Yes. Patty was more hands off. No, Fred was a trip. Like that was a fun process too. That Limp Bizkit thing was bugged out. That was playing on that record. And watching their creative process. Like I think I have a res I never liked, you know, back then I was I, it's not even that I didn't like Limp Bizkit, it was like hated Limp Bizkit. Like I
Yeah, it was
hate
an
these guys.
active hatred thing back
Yes,
then.
like I
Yeah.
fucking hate this band. But after being able to, you know, make a record with them, I have a respect for all those dudes, and like they have a, you know, a success and a formula that works. And so yeah.
Seeing him become a hardcore kid this late in life has been one of the most shocking things to happen.
Yeah, it's yes. I mean, I think that yeah, he's he just seems like he's just interested in a lot of shit, and but it's tough to maybe, you know. Yeah, I don't know where he's rooted in. It's hard to take him seriously, I guess, but I think he's genuinely like interested in shit. You know, whether it was hip hop or hardcore, whether he got into it after the fact or whatever, or not the right record or the right record. But the dude is like, you know, his output of, as far as like signing bands, like signing, you know, signing Puddle of Mud, signing that other band with the S and the ballads. I don't know. Like he's just
Oh,
like,
yeah, what are they fucking called?
yeah.
Strained. Strain?
Yeah, that
Strain?
band, and like even like She Wants Revenge, he said he signed, and just like, you know, he's making movies and just like that level of output. And then to be, have a band that sells 60 million records worldwide or whatever the fuck it is, like you gotta, you know, like him or not, you gotta give it, it's kind of cool.
Remember him sniffing around No Warning, too, when No Warning was going to sign to like a major around that time, like the Linkin
Yeah.
Park kind of era, too. So.
Yeah, he was like, I think he told me he wanted to start a like a hardcore band with Todd Youth or something, and wanted me to play in it. There was a moment there where like he was at Crossroads and Todd Youth was there, and you know, there was, but yeah, like I don't know. The world
Wow.
is crazy.
Well,
I did it all for the nookie, man.
I did it all for a Chungking can suck it, and
Yes.
I will continue to keep doing it until I get one. Thank you, Sammy,
When
for
is this
coming.
coming out, by the way?
When you need it out.
I was gonna say, like, we could make like a big reveal, like so Rev is gonna put out Chunk Cake and Suck It, but we're flipping the colors to white on black, and
Oh, whoa.
we remastered it, and it's basically for anybody that wants it, but while but without hopefully taking away any you know, for the people that have the original, then they still have that, and that's cool. So that's exciting. Psyched on that. Hopefully people won't be bummed, but I think it's a cool thing to put it out there.
You gotta call it Lost and Found can suck it.
Lots of yes. Exactly. All right, brother. Thank
Anytime
you.
you want to come back on here, Sammy, you are always welcome.
I love it, dude. This was fun. Thank you, man.
It can get lonely climbing Mount McKinley, so to entertain myself, I go to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, I can play hundreds of online casino-style games for free, like online slots, bingo, slingo, and more. Plus, I get a daily login bonus. It's just too bad that up here, I don't have anyone to share my excitement with. Woohoo!
Chumba. live the Chumba life anytime, anywhere. Play for free now at ChumbaCasino.com.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.